apologies for the quality of the audio on this recording. I had a few unexpected issues with the room we recorded the podcast in, but I think you'll enjoy it anyway.
This is the No Dogma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Trevor Stricker, indie game developer. Thanks for joining me, Trevor.
Thanks for talking to me.
Can you tell me a little bit about who you are and what you do, please?
So I make video games. I've made video games since the Dreamcast. My first game was a Dreamcast launch title, NBA 2K. It was massively successful. They're still making it. And I made console games for about 10 years. And then in 2008, I went indie. My first game as an indie was a rhythm game for the Nintendo DS. Back when that was an amazing platform and Nintendo was just starting to talk to indies. And that company was a big black smoking crater. My next indie game was Quick Hit Football, which was an online free-to-play football game. We signed with the NFL, became Quick Hit NFL Football, and we sold the company, which was very nice. And after that, I started another indie game company called DiscoPixel. We launched a rhythm game on PlayStation Vita and on iPhone, iPad called Jungle Rumble. And that's what I do.
How would you define an indie game developer as opposed to a game developer who works for a studio?
You know, what is indie? It's a question of dogma, and this is the No Dogma podcast. I think, you know, you could argue that games started out indie right here in Boston with a bunch of people who didn't want to make corporate software, discovering that they could sell text adventures. They were called Infocom. They made a game called Zork, and they built a company around that. I think for my generation, when I left college, the only way you could really make video games and have somebody pay you was if you joined a huge, massive studio and you were a cog in the machine. But of course, I always wanted to make my own games. So some people define indie as not corporate. Some people define indie as art, because whereas a traditional publisher would have a matrix and say, okay, I want to make these genres, first-person shooter and driving and strategy, and I want to target these market segments, and I want to find games that fit in those holes in that spreadsheet. As an indie, I say, I want to make a weird game where you control monkeys by drumming on the screen of your mobile device, and I want it to have an environmental message. And that's indie. And I got really depressed the other day because I was looking at some art packages online, and one of them was talking about how it's inexpensive, it's affordable, because it's nothing that fancy, and it's even suitable for just indies.
Just indies.
And that made me feel really bad.
When does an indie become more mainstream? So, you know, you mentioned company and corporate a few times. If a bunch of indie developers come together and they form a company, are they indie anymore?
You know, I suppose you could make religious arguments on either side of that. Me, I'm in the camp that Minecraft was 100% pure indie until they sold the company. And, you know, the fact that they had $1 billion plus exit, does that mean they're not indie? Well, I certainly hope that being indie does not preclude making money.
No, of course. So as you pretty much work by yourself, is that correct?
Jungle Rumble, we had 7 people on the project.
But in a more broad sense, okay, I suppose if I take it out a little bit, a lot of indie developers would work independently. And then they need a very broad range of skills. So I, as an engineer, I've got my back-end skills and I ignore the front-end. But you, as an indie developer, if let's say you're an independent sole developer, you're going to need back-end skills, front-end skills, music, art, and then also being able to design a good game. Is that a feasible thing for a person to have all those skills?
You know, I think The really compelling indie games that I see tend to come out of teams that tend to have a core of two, maybe three people. So there's, of course, Flambeer, but they don't suit the message I'm saying. What tends to happen is there's different aspects, like you were just talking about. There's the art aspect, there's the engineering aspect, there's the design aspect. And often you see teams of two people where one person has a subset, like it might be design and engineering, and the other person has the art skills.
How would you see yourself, though? Do you see yourself as the design artist or more of the engineering developer?
I am definitely a programmer first and foremost. You just saw a prototype I was working on. Mm-hmm. There is no way to confuse that as not being programmer art.
Yeah. So how would you suggest? So let's say I consider myself a relatively good engineer, mm-hmm. but I'm absolutely no good at making something look pretty. If I wanted to get into indie games, is it sufficient that I can program and I'll be able to find someone who can do the art for me?
Yeah, in fact, that's one of the cool things about indie game communities. And there's tons of them everywhere. And in Boston, we happen to have an especially frenetic and frothy one. There are so many artistic people out there who want to make video games. And there's so many ways to find them. You know, you can go to indie game meetups. You can hang out on deviantart.com or TIG Source or, I don't know, Reddit. I'm sure there's tons of them online. But yeah, that is the thing. People meeting, talking about the kind of games they want to make. Game jams. So game jams are these things where you go somewhere for an hour, a day, a weekend, and you make a game. Typically with people you've just met. And that's a really interesting way to connect with new people.
I imagine that's also a very easy way for someone who wants to start and get into the industry a little bit, because the game jam, you're going to meet people who are more experienced but who still need help.
It can be, for sure. I think people who've done this a long time tend to shy away from game jams because that's what I do each and every day. But that being said, in January, a whole bunch of us from here at the Indie Game Collective did the Global Game Jam, and we had an awesome time.
I've seen, or some of my friends are beginning to develop games independently, but they said there's quite often problems of people taking each other's ideas and taking a successful, simple app from the store and then replicating it and re-releasing it. Do you see that occurring in the indie sphere, or is it more opportunistic, malevolent people that are out there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it definitely happens. There's different levels of malevolence. You know, there are people who are clearly just spammers, like the guy who made Ninja Fishing out of Ridiculous Fishing.
Sorry, okay, you'll have to explain that. I don't know what you're talking about there.
Ridiculous Fishing is a game that was made by Flambeer where you're fishing with machine guns.
Okay.
You know.
Why not?
Why not? And they released it as a free Flash game. It got really popular. And they're like, cool, we're going to make an iOS version of this. And somebody else beat them to it, came out with Ninja Fishing. And it was awful. And that was pure spam, pure like, oh, this game has a lot of attention. We're going to make the same thing. But, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, there are companies like Zynga, who, not so much recently, but in their formative years, would say, look, we're not here to win awards for game design. If we see something that works, we're going to fast follow that. And make the same thing, but the value we add is in the marketing and in the traffic acquisition and in, well, I guess that kind of is spam. But you understand my point.
So do the typical intellectual property rules and copyright rules apply to games, or is it just much more difficult for an indie game developer to pursue that?
Well, you can't copyright a game mechanic.
Okay, I don't know these things. So what do you mean you can't copyright a game mechanic?
The mechanic itself,
yeah.
You can't copyright.
What is the mechanic?
What you're doing in the actual game itself. So you can copyright things like the name chess. You can copyright the name of your king. But you can't copyright the rules that say I have a piece that can go forward two and over one.
I see. So pretty much anyone can mimic your game as long as they didn't steal your code. Effectively, they haven't done anything wrong.
Yeah.
And they haven't called it the same as what you called it, perhaps.
Yes. But I think, you know, you have to look at it from another perspective, which is the really valuable thing of a game is not necessarily the end product, but the execution. So that's the thinking that went into creating it, and also the platform that you use to market and distribute it. So another famous cloning case last year was a game called Threes. It was an iPhone puzzle game. Okay. Super hugely successful. Somebody blatantly knocked it off and called it 2048. And when the guys who made Threes were like, what are you doing here? You know, we made this game. 2048 open sourced their game. So now there's just
Everyone got it.
But what was interesting is Apple now really cares about indie game development. They see themselves as a premium platform, and they want the good stuff. And they understand that the good stuff comes from people like me who really care deeply about the games we make. It comes from people like, you know, traditional game publishers like Electronic Arts that have huge budgets and deep know-how. But it doesn't come from people who see something simple and knock it off. So, you know, the best thing Apple can do for you if they like you is to feature you, and they feature Threes all the time. To my knowledge, they've never featured 2048.
To change tack a little bit, mm-hmm. What platforms do you develop for?
I develop for every platform that people play games on.
Can you list a few?
So our last game, Jungle Rumble, came out for iOS and for PlayStation Vita. And really, we chose those because it was a touchscreen rhythm game, so we needed a touchscreen. So I would have loved to come out for Xbox One and PlayStation 4 and PC, but you'd really smudge up your monitor while banging on.
Is it easy to develop for multiple platforms at the same time, or would you target one initially and then move to the next?
It's easier now than it's ever been if you use some of these massively cross-platform engines like Unity,
which we'll talk about soon.
I super love. But it's not straightforward. It's definitely easier than it used to be, where you would have to completely recompile everything, often in a different compiler for a different architecture from scratch. And you try and make it as cross-platform as possible, but you know, in practice, there's always things that just would vary so much, especially in the last console generation, where you had the Xbox 360 that was roughly, well, it was PowerPC, but let's say it was roughly worked the way that a standard computer did. And then you had the PlayStation 3, which had an asynchronous architecture with a CPU and these different SPUs that had a different instruction set, a different way to access memory, and a different cache layout, and it was crazy.
So I imagine this ties in a tiny little bit with the whole thing of people ripping your idea off. If you were to release on one platform and not on the others, it would give an opportunity for someone else to come in on those platforms before you. So I presume there's a strategic advantage to at least trying to release on multiple platforms relatively soon after each other.
Yes, or even simultaneously.
So if possible.
I think the one real challenge with that, though, is different platforms have different people, tend to kind of have different player bases, and you reach them in different ways. So, you know, when we launched on PlayStation, Sony was amazingly helpful about putting us out there, about, you know, sending us to trade shows like the PlayStation Experience in Vegas and talking about us on the PlayStation blog and posting us on the YouTube channel. Now, I don't know if anybody who buys a lot of games on Steam really pays attention to the PlayStation Experience in Las Vegas or the PlayStation YouTube channel. So it's a lot of work. Now, if you're a big company and you have a marketing department, well, maybe you can handle that. If you're DiscoPixel, it's a lot more work.
You've mentioned Unity. Is that your primary engine that you use?
Yes, I love Unity. I want to name my first child Unity. I would get a Unity tattoo.
Why? What's so good about Unity?
It's lightning in a bottle. I mean, I've only made games professionally for about 18 years. I've yet to see anything even remotely as interesting as Unity.
All right, so I'm an engineer. I have barely heard of Unity. So what does Unity, describe Unity to an engineer who builds business apps?
So it's a game engine. So a game engine handles all the nitty-gritty stuff that many games have in common. So this would be rendering models and animation and loading assets off the disk and playing audio and stuff like that. So how things used to work in the bad old days, this still happens at a lot of big studios, is you would reinvent the wheel for every new game. So a game takes, you know, three-ish some odd years to make, give or take a year or two. And every 5 years, there's a radical new generation of technology. So you start on a new game, and you're like, okay, I've got to get my 3D models out of Max or Maya or whatever we're using, and figure out a way to get them to display in my game engine. Okay, so you wrote an exporter out of Max and out of Maya, and then you figured out the mesh format for whatever the hardware is, and you converted that, and you know, you wrote the functions that grew the meshes when you wanted them to draw, and you did that pretty much for every new game. In fact, a lot of game studios in the 2000s would have a tech group, and a lot of game studios still have a tech group, but they would consider the fact that they could leverage their technology to multiple games as a strategic advantage.
From a programming language perspective, is Unity a C#? Mm-hmm. Okay, so I, as again, as a C# developer, I can just go in and use C#. But let's say you're a Java developer, can you use Unity? Or do you have to transition to C#
Java and C# are
relatively similar, yeah. But okay, but it doesn't support multiple languages, it just supports C#.
It does. It also supports a JavaScript variant and something called Boo.
Boo.
But most people use C#.
Are there other tools you'd recommend to a person who wants to get into games along with Unity to complement it with something?
So if you want to get into game development, mm-hmm. there are so many Unity tutorials out there. If you Google Unity tutorial, I bet the first 5 pages on Google are actual credible things that people have used to figure out how to use Unity, including some from Unity themselves. Tools wise, you know, we were just talking about this. I use Visual Studio as my IDE. Mm-hmm. It's pretty good.
So very familiar to most C# developers.
And you know, Microsoft came up with C#, which is pretty well supported. And
did I read that Unity uses a relatively early version of the framework?
Yes. So this is in the process of changing, and not necessarily in a very standardized way. So Unity, under the hood, used the Mono platform, yeah. which was an open source implementation of C#. And because Unity is so radically cross-platform, they can't upgrade their version of Mono that easily. So, I mean, you know, just in our conversation, we've talked about PC and iOS and PlayStation. Well, I mean, they support Android, and they support BlackBerry, and they support Windows Phone, and they support set-top boxes, and I mean, it's crazy. So, yeah, it's unfortunate. I would say the main drawback to the fact that they still use C# 2.0 is that it's still a synchronous, single-threaded garbage collector.
No. Okay.
And but what they're transitioning to now is something called LVM to CPP. LM. It's basically... They are using... They have this incredibly complicated pipeline, and who knows if this will actually work in the long term, or if it was just too complicated to ever function, that takes the intermediate language generated by the C# compiler, compiles that to C++, and then feeds that C++ into a platform-specific compiler.
I guess you have to make compromises, obviously, if you want to support those many, or that many range of devices with the mono. But there have been so many advances in the C# language and .NET framework that you're obviously missing out on. Is there a move to bring Unity up to the 4.5s or the 4.5.1s?
So, it's interesting. So every year there's a Unite conference, and this question always comes up. When are you going to give us a new version of .NET? And the real response is, well, what features do you want of the newer versions of .NET? And they have actually introduced certain newer features, I think, in the generic container libraries. I'm not sure. You know, the big one's always garbage collection. Mm-hmm. Well, the cool thing about what they're doing now is they've actually re-implemented just a different garbage collector. So hopefully it can be multi-threaded and asynchronous and multi-generational, which .NET 2.0 didn't have. But really, it's not so much about language features. I mean, a language is a tool. It's more about how well you know the tool that you're using and what you're using it to do.
Yeah.
I've never been sitting there stymied wishing that there was some .NET 4.5 feature that would make my life that much easier.
Oh, fair enough. Let me again change tack slightly.
Yeah.
Partnerships seem to be very important.
Sure.
Can you say why?
Yeah, because I guess the difference between a globetrotting indie game developer who makes games that people actually play and a bedroom coder is talking to people and have other companies invested in our games and in our success.
And you've built up partnerships in your time.
Yeah. We partner with a number of companies. So one thing we were talking about before that's public is Alienware. Alienware actually sponsors all of the studios in the Boston Indie Game Collective. And that's why we have these snazzy i7 Alienware PCs that we do day-to-day development on. We could consider Apple a partner because we talk to them. They tell us the type of things they like to see. I tell them the types of things I like to see. And, obviously I'm a big fan of the platform. Mm-hmm.
What about with other indie game developers? Do you partner with people outside of your company?
Sure, collaborating to make titles. At DiscoPixel, we haven't yet, but that's not to say we wouldn't. In fact, a local game recently became pretty prominent, Elegy for a Dead World. It's a game about writing.
Writing.
And that was two local studios collaborating, Dejabon Games and Pop Cannibal.
Nice. As a preference for yourself, in terms of scope, do you go for simple games, minimalist games, or would you like more expansive, big games?
So this is very much about what type of a designer you are, what type of an artist you are. I don't know if they can hear the janitor.
We have a little bit of background noise, so hopefully it won't be too prominent in the recording.
You know, me personally, I'm a minimalist. I hate unnecessary curlicues and frippery. I hate when I'm playing a game and there's something really interesting and compelling about this particular game, but then they're like, oh, here's a system to level up your sidekick. And I'm like, I don't even need a sidekick. Just let me blow stuff up in my jet.
And how do you resist that then? If you're doing a collaborative thing with multiple people, and one person wants to go one way and your experience tells you the other, do you have to come to an agreement or a compromise, or do you have creative control in your games?
Well, that's kind of a inherent in any creative process with multiple people. It kind of depends on your rapport and how you guys work together.
No, fair enough. So if you make a successful game that's deployed across multiple platforms, but you have some sort of back-end system involved, be it for score or for multiplayer, that back-end system at some point is going to have to scale, and that may well be a very significantly different set of skills than from building the game. How do game developers deal with that?
That is what they call a first-class problem.
Okay.
So it depends. Now, a lot of the things that games have in common are handled by the platform itself. So leaderboards used to be, you wanted to make an online game, well, you had to make a leaderboard server and figure out how to do that yourself. Well, now on iOS, Apple's got leaderboards. On Steam, Steam's got leaderboards. And if your game is so hyper successful that it floods Steam with traffic, then
it's not a bad complaint.
Invite me onto your private jet and tell me how you did it. But, you know, a lot of games do other more sophisticated things. Maybe you have a multiplayer game and you've got an intermediation server in the middle, or you've got actual logic itself in that server. So fortunately now we live in the age of the cloud, and you can design your backend in such a way that it's scalable. The problem is, the way games tend to work is you don't know how much it's going to scale, and it does take time and effort to architect something in such a way that you can just throw servers at it and it still works. So I guess the hard answer is time and effort. And the short answer is a lot of indie games avoid that problem by not being massively multiplayer online games.
When it comes down to it, you're here to make money. Is this something that's viable? Is it viable to make money out of indie games for a lot of people? Or is it, would more people end up just doing it as sort of a part-time on the side thing?
Well, I've been doing it since 2008, so 7 years.
As full-time professional?
Full-time, and I'm not starving.
No.
Unfortunately. Wait, no, that sounds bad. No, I don't think it's viable for lots of people to do. I think it's hard, and a lot of people try it, don't necessarily make it self-sustaining, and they do it as a hobby. And as a hobby, it's pretty cool because you make something and you can get it out there, and it's creatively satisfying. And there's always the chance that you'll make a Flappy Bird and this doofy little project you made in your bedroom takes off and you start making money. But it's the kind of thing, the world is constantly in a state of flux. The ways that people make money with games nowadays are radically different than 5 years ago. And 5 years ago, they were radically different than 5 years before that. I think the interesting thing is, it's one of these things where the more you know, the more you realize you just have no clue about. And it's, you'll never do a perfect job at everything. And, you know, often you see games that just come out of nowhere and it's like, well, how'd that happen? And it's like, oh, well, they were really active on Twitter. So you're like, okay, I've got to figure out Twitter. And then you realize, I'm just not a big fan of Twitter. Like, I use it, but, you know, just connecting the dots and doing a perfunctory job is not going to make your game big or profitable. So there's no real one answer. There's so many different business models out there, whether it's free-to-play and monetizes with ads, or free-to-play and monetizes with in-app purchases, or whether it's premium, which is a stupid word for a game that you pay money for, or, you know, often you can get paid by a platform company to develop a game for their platform, which is great if you can get that. Sony's been fantastic about supporting the radical fringe of indie games with their pub fund. And there's still publisher funding out there, which is the way games got made in the old days of shrink wrap retail. You know, I mean, Electronic Arts still funds development. They're not going to fund a guy like me, but still happens.
When we were discussing this podcast, you mentioned a few books and you said you would like to bring up some of them.
Sure. So the first one is Creativity Incorporated by Ed Catmull. Ed is one of the founders of Pixar, kind of an illustrious company that's known for high technology and high creativity. And the thing that I picked up from it was that they don't structure themselves as this way to enable these high priests to come down and dictate what a movie is. They have this really almost organic process that they called the something or other meanings. Of course, I can't think of the word right now.
No big deal.
But basically, somebody who's who wants to make a film there, you know, once they're on the process of getting greenlit, they go into a room where all these other eminent directors who've won Academy Awards and made films for Pixar pick apart their ideas in minute detail. And this isn't somebody pitching their movie by just talking to these guys. This isn't somebody pitching their movie even with a PowerPoint. This is a director at Pixar who puts together a short film and an amazingly flashy presentation to pitch to these people. And the thing that I really took from this was that the most valuable thing to come out of that meeting is candor. So when you're a creative person, when you're trying to come up with interesting ideas, when you tell them to a friend, they like you. They're going to be like, oh, that sounds really cool. You know, you're going to be like, I want to make a game where you fly a dragon through Boston shooting at stuff with your fire breath. They're going to be like, that's so clever. Ha ha. Of course, your friend likes you, so they want to be positive. They probably don't make games, so they won't see all the holes in it. What you really want is for somebody to be like, so you're going to be flying around shooting fire in a place where nobody has arrows? Like, where's the challenge? I don't get it. Like, that just, where's the game there? You really want this candor. So, of course, a trivial example is easy to talk about. But when you make something, you're personally invested in it. And people don't like to give you uncomfortable truths about something that you've made.
No, they don't. I think people are hesitant to. They think they're going to be discouraged. It's going to discourage you, and it may for some people.
And it may. And honestly, if you're at all discouraged, then don't make video games as a vocation because it's very discouraging. But when Ed was writing about, they'd have this process, and the thing that they valued the most was candor, and that was the word he used, candor. That just really struck a chord with me, that when you're trying to make something and somebody who, you know, has some sort of expertise, has an opinion of some credibility, takes their time and energy to actually play it, think about it, and shares his candid thoughts that may or may not be pleasant, that's gold.
And you'd encourage that in the indie gaming industry, to talk to but I presume you'd suggest that people talk to other game developers as opposed to just friends.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, even your friends can be useful sometimes. Yeah. But
It's preferable if a person has an eye for that particular topic.
You know, I would say if they've made games that you respect, then you should respect their opinion.
Yeah. Very good. Trevor Stricker, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Brian, thanks for talking.
The opening music was The Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Warm Evening by Nameless Dancers from the album Morning Touches.